I have a handout here that goes with Martin's talk, and I'm going to introduce him briefly, and then I'm going to run around the room and hand them out. When this paper was first put together and first announced, James DePogne was going to be here, but through a mishap in scheduling lecture performances, he was unable to attend. I didn't want to cancel the paper, and luckily Martin Williams, who was closely associated with this project, came forward and said he would be very happy to take over for Jim DePogne. I've introduced Martin at so many conferences in the last two or three years that in fact, there's no reason to do it, so I'm not going to, and here he is.
Thank you, Peter. Your usual gracious introduction.
I do my best for you.
I was involved with this book from the beginning, and Jim did the hard part, and I had the fun. So, but I can, I think, speak on it with some knowledge, even authority, perhaps. The book is Collected Piano Music of Ferdinand Jellyo Morton, and it's a formidably long book, as you see. And I think the book sets precedence not only for similar publications in jazz, but I think for similar publications of authoritative editions of music, musicians, composers of all kinds in this century. And all of that involves recordings in ways that I will make clear as we go along. So what I am saying is, here we have a complete scholarly edition of the compositions of one man, a major portion of which could not have been done without consulting recordings. So records play a part in this kind of scholarship, I think, in my experience, for the first time, anywhere, anytime. But they will play a similar role in ways we will get to as we go along in all such definitive editions of all composers from now on, or they should, for the reason we'll get to. I think that the best way to introduce this guy is to go right to a piece of music. And we will do that. What we're going to hear now is a passage, one of the most familiar passages from the literature of the swing bands of the 1930s and early 40s. Almost every band had a version of this. This particular treatment of it began in the Fletcher Henderson Orchestra, was then passed to Benny Goodman, passed to almost everybody else, and a lot of the others even had the gall to record it along the similar, almost exactly the same kind of an arrangement. It goes like this. That's the beginning of the main section, we'd better call it, in that arrangement, of a piece called King Porter's Stomp. And as I say, all bands played it, and they played it pretty much the same way, that way. However, if the composer heard it in that kind of performance, he would explain, often in a very loud voice, that's not the way it's supposed to go. You're leaving out one of the sections of the piece. You're stretching that section much too far. This is how it's supposed to go. And nine times out of ten, apparently, he would jump up on the bandstand if they'd let him, sit down at the piano, and demonstrate as follows. Go. You gotta be on the ball here, man. Thank you. Okay, now let's back up on this and let me tell you how this book came about. The real point of departure here was the publication of Collected Piano Music of Scott Joplin, done by Vera Lawrence and published by New York Public Library. That book resulted in a remarkable series of events, which of course ended up with an Academy Award movie score. But the most important aspect of that was that a lot of people discovered something that some of us are smug to say that we had known for a long time, which was that Scott Joplin was a very important American composer. And it was Vera's edition of those pieces which established that in their minds, or which helped him. That was the beginning of that kind of recognition for his music. I might point out smugly it only took 70 years, and I will, and I have, but I'll try to refrain from that kind of thing from now on. That is the way these things are done. I think everybody in this room knows that. There is a cultural establishment in the world at large which can only have that kind of an issue impressed upon them by that kind of an event. That is to say, the importance of Joplin as an American composer can only come through to them with a publication of the kind of book that Vera produced. It seemed to me, therefore, that there should be more of that kind of thing, since I had very strong convictions about other American composers, his associates in ragtime, and his successes in jazz. It also seemed to me that it was time to try to move into jazz and to try to find some way to publish a definitive edition of a jazz pianist composer. How do you do that? Well, first of all, whom do you do? Why not the first one? Morton has been called the first great jazz composer. He was a pianist, which simplifies the problem. You can publish him as a pianist composer. He also worked with ensembles up to 7 and 8 pieces, and even larger than that on some occasions. So therefore, there's that aspect of his career. But let's stick to the pianist, it seemed to me. And I'm talking as though this were my project, but frankly, at this stage, it really was. And then I was very, very fortunate enough, finally, after a lot of agony and effort, to find Jim DePogne, who had made his early reputation not only as a teacher and musicologist, but also as a serial composer. That is, I learned later how Gunther Schuller first came to know him, had no idea that they shared an interest in jazz, had no idea that as it developed, Jim DePogne's first real experience with music was listening to a Jelly Roll Morton record when he was 11 years old and being very moved by it. Involved with it. But when I found him, all of that did come out between us. All right, now, if you're going to do an edition of a composer player like Morton, first of all, you have certain basic questions to decide. What are the piano works of Jelly Roll Morton? My decision was this: anything that he had recorded as a piano solo that he wrote, that is, of his own compositions, would be a candidate. Anything which he had recorded, that is, on a record, but also, and this became important as we'll see, on a piano roll himself, if he had made a roll of it himself. And you could authenticate that roll because there are some doubtful items there. Or, the final thing, if it was published during his lifetime as a piano piece but did not otherwise appear as a piano work. So those three categories. Now, remember, we're talking about musicians, and I don't think we have all quite realized this, but in jazz musicians, we're talking about people for whom making a recording is the equivalent of publication. That's what it is. Now, granted, he did publish as well. Frequently, the published versions of the piano solos, as is the case with all jazz musicians, and still is the case, alas, are grossly simplified, so that even you or I might be able to play them. Okay, that was the definition of what were the piano works, and we made a list. Now, how do you then treat King Porter's Stomp, or The Pearls, or Wolverine Blues, or any of the other great pieces by Jelly Roll Morton? Do you listen to all the recordings, consult all the publications, consult all the piano rolls, and decide which one you like best and then notate that off of recording or roll or however, put that on paper and say, this is it. In other words, to paraphrase this slightly, do you make the same mistake with jazz musicians that we have made for a couple of centuries with a Baroque concerto? Do you put on paper what you like and assume that that's exactly what they played each and every time? Except, of course, for the harpsichord part, but we've discovered that there was much more to it than there was much more to spontaneity, ornamentation, and embellishment in the Baroque concerto than just the harpsichord. Well, we did not want to do that. We did not want to make the reader, the buyer, the scholar, assume that the King Porter Stomp was whatever Jim put on paper from one source that he happened to pick. We wanted to acknowledge the fact that any performance of that piece by the composer would not be like any other performance. So the procedure we hit on was this. Jim DePagny picked one recorded performance which he thought was the best for various reasons, but not the ideal. There's a difference there. Then he proceeded to notate that painstakingly, carefully, and I think with astonishing accuracy off of recordings, some of which were made as early as 1923 on equipment out in the Middle West for small companies, which was already well out of date by the time they were using it on these jazz musicians. So, I mean, you know, the recorded quality here is, to put it mildly, low and difficult to decipher in the bass line, to say the least. But Jim has done that. He's done all of that. Okay, now, then, having notated that one version of the piece, the decision was to append to that all the major differences between that version and all the other recorded versions, if they had some essential difference, some important difference, some singular difference. I'll demonstrate those differences in a moment. And that was to be the book. So that a notation of this piece, to go back to the one we just heard, King Porter's Stomp, would have an appendix, perhaps, of other, drawn from other recorded versions of King Porter's Stomp. As it happens, I picked a bad example there, because there were no really important differences among the recordings of that piece that he found worth notating. I mean, one could argue that point, certainly, because that doesn't sound like any other version of King Porter that I've ever heard or that he's ever heard. But those differences did not seem essential to Jim. Now, you notice here we've got another implication for this book in addition to what I've said, and that is, if you do go through, let us say, the pearls in everything that Jim has notated, you are beginning to learn to improvise necessarily in Jelly Roll style, because, which is the ultimate aim, of course, of learning to play this music, learn to improvise within this idiom yourself, because you learn to get, you learn the characteristics of the kind of variations, ornaments, and embellishments that he made. This kind of notation would not be needed in a book of ragtime, even if we had the resources. Rag players, you could be, I think, a great ragtime performer without any ability at spontaneity at all. That doesn't mean that they didn't have it. They did. They obviously, they absolutely did ornament and embellish in performance. But that was not essential to ragtime. That kind of spontaneity is essential to jazz, and that is what we didn't want to ignore in this book. And it was certainly essential to this man, who improvised a great deal more than many of his contemporaries, if we're to judge by the surviving recordings and published music. Okay, this book adds up to 500 pages, roughly, of notated music and other comment. And I'm going to draw my first example here from a piece called The Pearls, which is probably, it may be the masterpiece of all of Jelly's pieces. It is certainly one of the four or five best he ever wrote. As presented in the book, there is a 9-page transcription from a particular recorded performance by Jelly Roll, which Jim DePagny did, of The Pearls, 9 pages of The Pearls. Added to that are 10 pages of important differences between that version and all the other recorded versions which Jim consulted and decided to include. And that includes, in this case, a piano roll of The Pearls, by the way. Just to go down the list, in the beginning of The Pearls, you will see that he recorded it on July the 18th, 1923. That was consulted here. On April 1926, that was consulted here. On June 1927, with an orchestra, he listened to that to see if he could pick up anything essential that related to a piano version. That it, by an orchestra, I mean a seven-piece, eight-piece group in that case. And in May, sometime in May or July of 1938 for the Library of Congress, and once later at about that period, we don't know the exact date. Now, he has drawn on all those things in this appendix to the Pearls. And if you learn to play it and learn to play all the differences, then you know how to improvise on it, theoretically. Okay, let's take two examples from different versions of the Pearls. The first one, as you see on your sheet, is the trio section from the first recorded version. This is not the one he chose to. Actually, in the way those pieces are structured, we're up to the point where the real ornamentation, embellishment, variation is supposed to start. And yet, let's go back to the beginning of that on the next recorded. The date is wrong on your sheet. It should be 26 rather than 23 for this version. But let's go back up to that point again, only 3 years later. Not even get into the real variational part, and it sounds like this. The problem of both of notation and deciding what belongs becomes more formidable. All right, let's try an example now from another source. This is the piece next listed on your sheet called Shreveport Stomp. And this again is from the trio section of that. By the way, the structures of these pieces is worth saying for any of you who don't know. The multi-thematic, if I can use that pompous term, structure of these early jazz pieces is, of course, derived from ragtime, but that in turn is derived from the Sousa-style march or its analogs in European dance music, which are the polka and the mazurka. That structure, in other words, you might say that ragtime is an Afro-American reinterpretation of the polka or the march. Which is really, if you reduce it down to its simplest terms, that's what it is. And this is another, and this is a further reinterpretation of that kind of structure. And so different rhythmically that we had to get another name for it, which was jazz. And in addition to the greater rhythmic variety, we have this built-in, this need for improvisation and spontaneity. Okay, now Shreveport is another such piece in three sections. And what you're going to hear is first of all, and we'll play these two through, from 1923, the very first piano recording, the only piano solo recording, by the way, or representation of this piece of any kind except in a trio of piano, clarinet, and drums, of Shreveport Stomp. But the second source here, and really quite different as you hear, and this gets notated in the book too, is a piano roll. So here's another kind of recorded performance which gives us another dimension on this piece. And for this particular piece, this is all we have. It's quite a bit, as you'll see. Okay, the roll was probably made in 24, but we don't know and probably never will. It's not that important. It's roughly from the same period. Okay, these two trios then of Shreveport. Isn't it wonderful to hear a piece of music that isn't fixed? It has no absolutes except the framework. And even as simple as that is, compared to what another generation of jazz pianists might have done. But one implication, by the way, that it's certainly worth my mentioning of going backwards, so to speak, from a recorded performance to paper is if I took, let's say, a fairly simple Chopin piece and ignored the printed music and took, let's say, three contemporary pianists who were good at Chopin and went back from each of those three performances to paper as though the Chopin didn't exist, I'd come up with three different notations, wouldn't I? If I really went for all the nuances and I really went for all the interpretive things I could hear, as he's done here, I'd probably end up with three rather different notations. Not so different as that, however. Okay. Pardon?
Hopefully.
Well, depending on
no,
who...
I'm not disagreeing with music, but I'm saying it's a different style.
Okay.
Sorry.
Right. There was one other category of piece that's in the book that I already mentioned, and that is the piece which was never recorded by him, by Morton himself, as a piano solo, but which did get published as one. Oh, I should have mentioned, by the way, there was a piece which exists in a piano version only on a roll, and that is a piece called Dead Man Blues. But there the problem, I'm backing up a little because I meant to mention this, but there the problem is a little bit different, because the piano roll was one of those rolls called vocal style, which was intended as a kind of sing-along device. So the piano is very simple, and in fact it goes through the whole routine exactly twice, so it was probably recorded once, just spliced together, but you could do that with paper, as you couldn't with recording in those days. But so what Jim has done there is to kind of elaborate on a kind of might have been interpretation of Dead Man Blues, because the role is much simpler than the kind of role you just heard. Well, okay, there is one piece which was recorded by the seven-piece group only, but was published in two different versions, actually, as a piano piece. That's a piece which is usually called Black Bottom Stomp. It's one of the great band records, one of the great Red Hot Peppers records. And it was published both as Black Bottom Stomp and also in its alternate title, and somewhat simplified there, as the Queen of Spades. Now, the reason it figures in the book, therefore, is that it got published, and that version called Black Bottom is very much the way Morton would have played it. It looks like a transcription of a piano solo that somebody very, very with good ears had done. It could have been just that. We don't know, but it could have been. However, in the Red Hot Peppers version of it, there is a solo chorus in the second section by the piano. And it, by the way, is a true solo. That is to say that all the other so-called rhythm instruments drop out and the piano solo is all by itself. It's a fascinating chorus because, for a long time, most pianists thought it had to be three hands, two on the bass and one on the treble. Jim DePogne decided to append that solo to Black Bottom in the book, as he should have, but he also has figured out, to his satisfaction, if not to anybody else's, a way that one pianist could have played it, and he sure did play it, and that pianist would be Morton himself, of course. Anyway, this is that piano solo from the band record of Black Bottom, which you will find in an appendix in the book to Black Bottom. And I'll leave it up to you, pianists in the room, which I am not one, to be sure, as to whether it is three hands or two. Whether it's three or two, I wouldn't want to have to play it. Now, the book, let me just talk about the book for a moment, because I'm trying, in a sense, to stir up a little business at this point. The book is a joint publication of G. Shermer and the Smithsonian Press. We are interested in theory, and I hope this will develop in practice, in doing several other books. I hope this will be the beginning of a series of books. Obviously, I think this is worth doing, this kind of publication of jazz composition, for a number of reasons, not the least of which is the one I've already given you. That is that there are some people who are going to be impressed by this kind of publication who would never listen to Morton's records of his own performances, or never pay any attention to him as an American composer otherwise. But there were other reasons for doing it besides that one, but I must admit that's primary. Therefore, I should say that Shermer has invested a lot of money in a book. You've said a lot of music here, and this all had to be set new. There was nothing reproduced here, there was nothing offset, there was nothing that we could draw on from previous publication except a couple of little things which even they had to be cleaned up. In passing, that I must say, that when Vera Lawrence did Joplin, she corrected several, quote, obvious typos, unquote, silently. That is to say, if there's something that looked like, you know, there was one wrong note in there because the music, the typesetter or however that the engraver had done it wrong, she would simply change that. Well, that does not seem to me to be the right thing to do in a scholarly publication, even though you're 99 or 100% convinced this is a simple typo in a simple B-flat chord. You don't do it that way. You footnote it. She didn't. I think it should be done. DePagny has meticulously footnoted all that. Missed notes and wrong notes and everything of the kind that he has changed off of what he hears on the recordings. When he's not quite sure what he's hearing on those old acoustical records, he will notate that. Every little thing. There are, however, inevitably some typos in this book, of course. Now, as I was saying, we would like to see this the beginning of a series of books. It has been a more expensive undertaking than Shermer is willing to follow through on exactly. But to do a version about half this length, let's say, of selected piano music of James P. Johnson, Earl Hines, Thelonious Monk, any and every pianist composer of importance in this idiom of music is something that we do intend to do. We would also like to see the ragtime slack taken up, so to speak, to say go backwards. Certainly Tom Turpin deserves an authoritative edition of his rags, and so do several others. So does James Scott, so does Joseph Lamb, so do many others. And I would like to see that come about too. That's easier and simpler to do, of course, because you don't have to contend with records. You should consult piano rolls in that case, in a discreet manner. But so. And I'm happy to be able to say to you that that James P. Johnson is in the works now, as are several other people. And wouldn't it be nice if, for me and for at least three or four other people in this room, if in our lifetime a definitive edition of Duke Ellington's piano music could appear? What an event that would be in American music. What an event. You know, until 2 years ago, when four of the orchestrations from 1940 and 41 were published, there had never been published anywhere in this country or anywhere else an authoritative version of any of Ellington's music. Everything that had ever appeared was simplified or simply wrong, and that event took place 4 years ago, or 3 or 4 years ago. Historic occasion, we will think, I think, for posterity will think. Okay, I'd like to play you a little Jelly Roll for fun now. This is a piece you will see down there in an outline, Mama Anita. That means Mama Anita. Anita Gonzalez was her full name. This was recorded three times, twice in 1924. Once, as you'll see, for that Midwest label, Paramount, whose equipment was probably up to date in 1905, but no later than that, that's a guess, but I'd say a pretty good one. This is because I picked this for several reasons. I love it. It's a marvelous piece. It's a little known piece, but also because it's a tango, and as those of you who keep up to date in these matters know, the tango is in current fashion in the top 40 lists, and I thought it would be worth paying for that reason. Jelly Roll wrote many, not many, but several excellent jazz tangos, of which this seems to me the best. There's a good question which musicology in this country has never settled finally and definitively. The tango and related rhythms like the habanera and the bolero and the Charleston, they are all basically the same rhythm. Our version of that kind of so-called Latin rhythm is, of course, the Charleston. Think about it as you hear this piece. Another point on that, by the way. I once asked a gathering of music critics, what is the habanera? And to a man and woman, they each said, it is a Spanish dance. And of course, I said, well, in that case, where is Habana? In Spain? All of those rhythms are Afro-New World rhythms, all of them. They are not Spanish, any of them. Never, never make a mistake about that. All of those rhythms in those dances. whatever Bizet and Ravel did with them, they were not found. But by the way, I'm told that the shakan comes from Mexico. These little known facts get thrown out now. Okay, Mamanita. You will see that I've outlined the structure here because I think following it is more fun. But you'll see two exclamation points, the second time through on the B section and the second time through on the C. And that is there because I want to draw your attention to the main device that is used here in making the variations. And they're centered in those two sections. The main device is to drop very, very far behind the beat until you as a listener, and particularly if you're not experienced in this kind of music, are sure that he has totally lost and will never get back where he's supposed to be. But he is not the least bit lost. Okay, the Paramount version of Mamanita. I said I think there are implications in this book for other kinds of music, and what I mean is this. Last year, David Hamilton told us about Stravinsky in the recording studio and what differences there were between records that he supervised or conducted or was involved in, between those as they came out on recordings and what was on the paper, what he wrote originally. This may sometimes be a simple matter of hearing what your mind's, your musical imagination is hearing and committing to paper in the score, and then when you hear it played by the musicians, it doesn't come out exactly the way you want it, or you think of something better, or whatever. Well, these guys are not quite up to this, and maybe I better simplify for them, or change it for them, or leave something out. But that is not only true of Stravinsky. Anybody who has ever consulted a Bartok score and listened to his recordings of the same piece is going to get some revelations. Another example we were talking about last night, and a very, very important and curious one in many ways, is Rachmaninoff. Now, if you are going to do a scholarly edition, I would say of any 20th century composer of any kind, you had better go to the recordings and see what you can learn from them and take that into account in the way that seems most advisable. I'm not talking, I know full well, to a room full of musicologists when I say that. So I take it for us as an organization devoted to recordings, I think it behooves us to get this message where it will do the most good and get it out. This is something that concerns us, but which should concern all music scholarship. But I think we are going to have to let music scholarship know that, because I doubt very much if they're going to discover it for themselves. That's not a cynical remark. I mean, this is a natural consequence of their traditions and the way they have been taught to do their research and their scholarship. But I think that must change for all music. In any case, I do hope that what Jim has done here with 10 years of extremely hard, painstaking, careful, conscientious work will set standards for all jazz editions of this kind, for all definitive published editions of the works of jazz composers, and particularly pianists, which, again, seems to me the place to start all this, but why end it there? We could end it with any kind of instrumentalist and any kind of jazz musician, even one who didn't compose. And that's the way to go, if we can lead it that way. I have another piece I want to play you if we have time, but in the meantime, I think I should ask for your questions and comments, and if you will. Yes, Phil?
Phil Elwood, San Francisco. Martin, do we have, I'm ashamed to even ask this, but do we have manuscript from Morton in his hand, complete manuscript compositions of piano solos?
I don't think we have any complete manuscripts of compositions. We have basic sketches for several, and they are in his hand, and indeed some of them are reproduced here.
Mm-hmm.
A typical comment of some of his musical and critical enemies has been that he didn't know very much music, but if you look at what's reproduced in this book, for instance, you know he knew very, very well, and he could notate anything he wanted to notate, and he didn't need help in notating.
Mm-hmm.
Then you'll find there are some pages reproduced here.
Thank you.
Yeah.
It's funny you mentioned Rachmaninoff.
Name yourself, Steve.
Oh,
I don't
Steve
know
Smolian. It's funny that you mentioned Rachmaninoff in this context. I wasn't present at this conversation yesterday evening when his name came up, but it seems to me that those wild syncopations where the basic beat seems to be getting more and more lostered is something that Rachmaninoff used in a number of his preludes at different times, and I suspect it was from this to him, perhaps, rather than the other way around. He's known to have gone to hear Tatum and people like that as well. I'd be curious to know your feeling about that.
Well, you know what my wish is, but I don't think I have any definitive opinion, so what I would like to think, and what I really do think, is yes, it did go in the direction from them to him and not the other way.
Sure.
It's irresistible once you've heard it. How could any musician not respond to that once you've heard them doing it? I mean,
Helen Roach, I'm wondering if you see a parallel in the historical method used by musicologists in not listening to the records, in the tendency until a few years ago of historians to consult written copies of things instead of the oral history possibilities of the area and the things that were recorded through oral history. That move, which began at Columbia University, I suppose, about 1954, directing attention and giving a certain prestige to the use of oral history in compiling material that had to do with history of man.
Of course I do, absolutely, and I'm glad you brought that up. And I'd modify that in two respects, or I would enlarge on it in two respects. First of all, They don't do it because they haven't been told they need to do it. And to put it bluntly, they need to be told they need to do it. And of course, they're intelligent enough to know, once they're reminded they need to do it, that's correct. But I think there's another aspect to this. When you're dealing with an aesthetic subject like music or poetry or painting or whatever, and this I think has to do with the way we did treat the Baroque concerto, that is to fix it into an absolute, except where it was obviously impossible to do that in the case of the harpsichord part. And that is this. I think we have all known scholars who have, if I may put it this way, retreated to positions of absoluteness when they're dealing with aesthetic subjects. That is to say, they may start out with an enormous enthusiasm for Keats's poetry and want to discuss it as poetry, but within 20 years, they are fussing over the minute facts of Keats's life, and they no longer seem to us, sometimes, and there are plenty of exceptions to this, but many scholars end up, you know, from my point of view, no longer interested in poetry or music or whatever. And I really think that is because, I've come to this conclusion lately, they have no training in aesthetics. Therefore, they are never trained to deal with these questions of which they would call only matters of opinion when they get to be 40 years old and over. They wouldn't have called them that at 20, but they come to do that. And therefore, they begin to treat music, let's say, as an absolute. They would not do what Jim DePogne has done here, which is to consult all the possible sources and take all the valid and interesting ones into account and put them on the paper. They would want to freeze. I think the traditional tendency would be to freeze this improvisation of music into something called the best version of Shreveport, and that's it. Now, I think in music,
would like to add an observation with regard to Shakespeare. It's very difficult to find in any curriculum the oral reading of Shakespeare as a subject of study. Mm-hmm. The Shakespeare course has to do with the Chandos portrait, reading in the third folio, and that kind of analysis. But never does the tongue of the student move into this aesthetic area of revealing Shakespeare in oral study. And when I was at University of Bristol some years ago, I asked the chairman, who had something to do with this area, and said, why don't you have a course in oral reading of Shakespeare? And he said, well, we'll probably come to that. Well, they haven't. But there is this negation which seems to have retreated to the mechanics and the things that have come through on a printed paper.
Yeah. You know, there's another aspect of that which you reminded me of by bringing up Shakespeare, which I could lay on you, because there is a parallel here. There are three surviving versions of Hamlet. Now, the scholar's idea of the way to do a definitive Hamlet is to put together all of all three of them and string this thing out to a three-hour play. That is as if Jim had taken all those versions of the trio and put them into a single performance, you see, which he didn't do, which would be wrong to do. This is the way we did it then, this is the way we did it then.
Yeah, I don't see Brad McEwen here. Last year or 2 years ago at IAJRC, he was talking about a Bix Beiderbecke reissue that they had done, where one of the things that one of the producers at RCA was considering doing was putting together, instead of putting take one, take two, take three of something, I think they had three takes of, and putting all three takes, which what they were thinking of doing was putting together Bix three solos in a row, and you know, opening the record, doing the solo from take one, take two, take three, then closing the record, and Brad was able to talk him out of doing that. And what they eventually did was just, they played the whole record of one of the takes and put the solos for one of the takes after that, and just the solos for one of the takes after that, so if you wanted to hear all three solos, you could. But what I was going to do is just comment just briefly on what Helen was saying and point out just another parallel, not oral histories, where we are interviewing people, But there are a lot of scholars which is still to this day, when it comes time for them to look at a speech of a public figure, will look to the printed text rather than looking to the recording. And there have been studies made showing one particular speech of Roosevelt, for example, another one of Lyndon Johnson, that you could have as many as five different texts, New York Times, government, etc. This is a directly parallel thing to your situation, because there we have a printed script which does not fit what the recording actually says, and so we have to, in both spoken word and music, convince people to use the recordings.
Okay, now that you've opened that can of worms, Mike, I better confess that I once did a record for Brad McEwen in which I included two piano solos by Count Basie from alternate takes. A, they were separated by an interlude, which means I didn't run them together and I wouldn't. And B, I said in the notes exactly what I was doing so that nobody could be confused. That still may not be a valid way to do it, but it seems to me a little better than stringing them together as though they were one solo.
Martin, can you report any progress in the Smithsonian's endeavors to release the Library of Congress Morton recordings?
No. Would that I could.
You're trying, though.
Oh, sure. We're going to do it.
Good luck.
We have permission to dub them.
Now that I know. I didn't want to say.
Yeah.
But
that doesn't mean we have permission to issue them. Yeah.
Hi, Jerry Gibson, Library of Congress, Martin.
Hi, Jerry.
In line with what Mike was saying, I don't know how many of you are aware that the Congressional Record, which is the official document of what takes place on the floor of the House and Senate, is heavily edited. There is only one copy. I don't know if, is Archives getting a copy of it now? There is now, for about 2 years running, 3 years now. The sessions that are actually taking place are recorded and copies are being retained in the Library of Congress.
The audio tape, it's almost
of,
right.
No, it's now video as well.
You're saving the videos?
Yes.
Okay, last year you weren't.
Well, I presume the appropriation has come through. If it has, we are. If it hasn't, we're not. Just like the broadcast companies, we need the tape. But there might be a definitive record someday of what happened in Congress, if you want it.
Yeah. Okay.
What do you do if you're a performer and you have all those alternative versions?
What do you do?
To choose from.
You make some decisions.
Yes, I know, but on
what
basis?
Performers are doing all the time.
Yeah. Yeah, I know, but do you have any suggestions for how you would base those decisions?
Oh, I wouldn't presume to advise performers.
Okay.
Let me make one final comment.
I can't comment?
Huh?
I can't make a comment?
I thought you were cutting me off.
No, I will after I make a comment and you make a comment, then I'll cut you off.
Deal.
I have yet to make a comment that isn't a commercial, but this isn't. I just wanted to mention, for those who don't know it, in this matter of alternative versions, there are two Kurt Weill pieces, one called Nana's Lead, which had a manuscript that was never published, never printed anywhere, and which turned up somehow on a French recording which Epic issued first in Canada and finally in this country some years ago, with an orchestral accompaniment and a French singer. No one involved with the Kurt Weill Foundation or with Lotta Lenya and could figure out how anyone could have found a copy of this music to begin with, but it was there. It was note accurate, but the orchestration, as those of you who know Kurt Weill, he always wrote his own. There had never been an orchestration for this piece, but somehow a recording was made with an orchestration, which sounded very Weillian, with no credit given. When Teresa Stratus did her Kurt Weill album, the unknown Kurt Weill, her first solo album, she recorded the solo piano accompaniment version, but again, this without the supervision of the composer, or even really Lotta Lenya, who was at that point not really totally involved. So we have two slightly different versions of a work that was never published, and of which there isn't even a definitive handwritten copy, since the manuscript was sort of tattered and broken up. But on that same record of Teresa Stratus's, there are two recorded, there's a joint recording of two versions of a song called Buddy on the Night Shift, which Weill wrote in two keys, with two very different accompaniments and two slightly different notations of the melody. There is no real definitive version of that, and she decided to record both of them.
Okay, my final remark would be something that I think would characterize Jelly Roll Morton, not his music, but the man. He was a colorful character, and I do not, never have wanted to dwell over that, but I'll tell you this much. I've often thought in giving jazz appreciation courses over the last 20 years, what would King Oliver, let's say, to pick another early figure, have thought if he had known that I'm standing up in front of an academic situation classroom talking about his music? I'm sure he would have been pleased, but he might have been a little puzzled. But if Jelly Roll Morton had known that one day this would come out, he would have said, of course.
Thank you, Martin, and in absentia, thank you, James DePogne, and thank you very much, Jelly Roll Morton.